morning again. William Stafford has long been one of my favorite poets, ever since I discovered him while teaching English at a community college in the town in Kansas where he graduated from high school. I realized a few months ago that I did not own a collection of his poems, so I went downtown and found one at Vargo's. It just blew me away, and I wanted to share his work with you. Stafford was born in Hutchinson, Kansas in 1914. His family moved often during the Depression as his father looked for work. In fact, at one time, Bill's paper route was the main source of his family's income. He graduated from high school in Liberal, Kansas, a town in the far southwest corner of the state. Then he went to community college for a couple of years and on to the University of Kansas. In and around his schooling, he worked many menial jobs at an oil refinery, in sugar beet fields, that sort of thing. After earning his bachelor's degree in English at KU, he started work on a master's degree. He was drafted, registered as a conscientious objector, and spent the war years in civilian public service camps in Arkansas and California. His memoir of that experience became his master's thesis at KU, and it was published by the Church of the Brethren as Down in My Heart, Peace Witness in Wartime. His brother Bob became a bomber pilot in the war, and his sister married a Navy sailor, but the family remained close. The copy of Down in My Heart in the KU library is inscribed as a gift from Bob Stafford. Bill met and married his wife Dorothy, who was the daughter of a Brethren minister while he was in the CPS camp in California. They had four children. To condense the rest of his story, he taught for decades at Lewis and Clark College in Portland, and he got a PhD from the University of Iowa. He did a few one-year teaching jobs at other places, and he traveled widely in the U.S. and abroad giving readings and workshops. He died of a heart attack in 1993, a couple of months after writing Godiva County, which is actually on this poster, which you will hear this morning. But let's begin with one of Stafford's better-known poems, and the one that first got my attention. One Home. Mine was a Midwest home. You can keep your world. Plain black hats rode the thoughts that made our code. We sang hymns in the house. The roof was near God. The light bulb that hung in the pantry made a wan light, but we could read by it the names of preserves. Outside, the buffalo grass and the wind in the night. A wildcat sprang at Grandpa on the 4th of July when he was cutting plum bushes for fuel before Indians pulled the west over the edge of the sky. To anyone who looked at us, we said, "My friend." Liking the cut of a thought, we could say, "Hello." But plain black hats rode the thoughts that made our code. The sun was over our town. It was like a blade. Kicking cottonwood leaves, we ran toward the storms. Wherever we looked, the land would hold us up. I want to talk about this for just a moment, just to satisfy my inner English teacher. I realized recently that I had a very specific reaction to one image, and I want to see if it's unique to me. What do you make of those black hats? Anyone? Bueller? Amish, and I heard something else over here, Blackson. Could be Jewish.
A witch's hat.
A witch's hat? Woohoo! Okay.
What about black clouds?
Oh, that's an interesting idea. Black storm clouds. Yeah. Well, around Hutchinson in south central Kansas, there are a lot of Mennonite communities, and Mennonites are Anabaptists like the Amish and the Hutterites. So that's what I thought of living in Kansas when I first read this. I often wondered if anybody would see the, you know, black hats equal bad guys from Westerns. It wasn't until I started working on this sermon that I thought of that one. But I also want to talk about that line, before Indians pulled the west over the edge of the sky. On a literal level, that doesn't make a lot of sense. What's the edge of the sky? How could anyone pull anything, let alone the sky, over that edge? Yet we have a deep sense of what is meant. And that, boys and girls, is how you know it's poetry. The language is figurative rather than literal, and much meaning is compressed into just a few words. Now, let's move on to some other poems, and we have readers from our congregation. The first set of poems reflect a very deep sense of place. The first one may originally have been intended to be about Kansas, but it works for Montana just as well. The next two explicitly refer to Montana. And one critic mentions in Stafford his attention to the vital but continually imperiled wilderness, which is evident in the poem Deanna will read. So, Mark. That's your cue.
Perhaps we needed more rehearsal. American Gothic. If we see better through tiny green glasses, we like to wear tiny green glasses. Our parents really us this view. It's tundra. We love it. We travel our kind of renaissance. Barn, folds of hay, whole voices of corn, a book that flickers its halo in the parlor. Poverty plus confidence equals pioneers. We never doubted.
Once in the 40s, we were alone one night on a long road in Montana. This was in winter, a big night, far to the stars. We had hitched, my wife and I, and left our ride at a crossing to go on. Tired and cold but brave, we trudged along. This, we said, was our life, watched over, allowed to go where we wanted. We said we'd come back sometime when we got rich. We'd leave the others and find a night like this, whatever we had to give, and no matter how far, to be so happy again.
Godiva County. This poem was written near Big Timber, Montana on June 16, 1993, about 2 months before Stafford's death. She's a big country. Her undulations roll and flow in the sun. Those flanks quiver when the wind caresses the grass. Who turns away when so generous a body offers to play hide and seek all summer? One shoulder leans bare all the way up to the mountain. Winds range and plunge down into the river. We risk our very eyes every day. They celebrate. They dance and flirt over this offered treasure. Be alive, the land says. Listen, this is your time, your world, your pleasure.
Roll call. Red wolf came, and passenger pigeon, the dodo bird, all the gone or endangered came and crowded around in a circle. The bison, the Irish elk, waited silent. The great white bear, fluid and strong, sliding from the sea, streaming and creeping in the gathering darkness, now down, bowing to earth its tapered head. For the black-footed ferret, paws folded, stood in the center, surveying the multitude, and spoke for us all. Dearly beloved.
And speaking for us all, we next come to a couple of poems in which Stafford speaks for the marginalized. The Ku Klux Klan was active in Kansas, and that's too bad, but it was. And Stafford's parents took him, when he was a boy, out to observe a Klan rally from a safe distance. There is a story in the family that as a small boy, he came home from school and reported that two black kids on the playground had been taunted by others. His mother asked, "And what did you do, Billy?" He said, I went and stood by them. Stood, not ran, not fought, stood. Robert Bly, in the introduction to his edition of Stafford's poems, states that Stafford had Native American heritage, so Bly put together a selection called Speaking the Native American Part in Him. But here's the thing. Stafford's son, Kim, says that if Stafford was part Indian, it was by conversion, not birth. Stafford and some cousins had decided as kids that if there were tribes named Crow and Blackfoot, there should be a tribe named Crowfoot. And they proclaimed themselves to be part of it. And Robert Bly fell for that. And yet, whether they're genetically Native American, certainly the poems that Bly selected to reflect that tradition do have a ring of authenticity. Report to Crazy Horse is rather a long poem, so we're dividing it between two readers. If you want to feel an extra impact, put your hand on your heart when Deanna reads.
The title of this poem refers to Gideon, a man commissioned by God to serve others with humility and compassion, serving with Gideon. Now, I remember in our town, the druggist prescribed Coca-Cola, mostly, in tapered glasses for us, and to the elevator man in paper cup, so he could drink it elsewhere, because he was black. And now I remember the Legion, gambling in the back room, and no women, but girls. Old boys who ran the town, they were generous to their sons or the sons of friends. And of course, I was almost one. I remember winter light closing its great blue fist slowly eastward along the street, and the dark, then deep as war, arched over a radio show called The 30s in the Great Old USA. Look down, stars. I was almost one of the boys. My mother was folding her handkerchief. The library, see the dance sparked, right and wrong art. And carefully, I walked with my cup toward the elevator man.
Report to Crazy Horse. All the Sioux were defeated. Our clan got poor, but a few got richer. They fought two wars. I did not take part. No one remembers your vision or even your real name. Now the children go to town and like loud music, I married a Christian. Crazy Horse, it is not fair to hide a new vision from you. In our schools, we are learning to take aim when we talk, and we have found out our enemies. They shift when words do. They even change and hide in every person. A teacher here says, hurt or scorn people are places where real enemies hide. He says, we should not hurt or scorn anyone, but help them. And I will tell you in a brave way, the way Crazy Horse taught, that teacher is right. I will tell you a strange thing. At the rodeo, close to the grandstand, I saw a farm lady scared by a blown piece of paper. And at that place, horses and policemen were no longer frightening, but suffering faces were, and the hunched over backs of the old. Crazy Horse, tell me if I'm right. These are the things we thought we were doing something about.
In your, excuse me. I saw many strange things, and I will tell you another. Now I salute the white man's flag. Before I salute, I hold my hand alertly on the heartbeat and remember all of us and how we depend on a steady pulse together. There are those who salute because they fear other flags or mean to use ours to chase them. I must not allow my part of saluting to mean this. All of our promises, our generous sayings to each other, our honorable intentions, those I affirm when I salute. At these times, it is like shutting my eyes and joining a religious colony at prayer in the gray dawn in the deep aisles of a church.
Now I have told you about new times. Yes, I know others will report different things. They have been caught by weak ways. I tell you straight, the way it is now, and it is our way, the way we were trying to find. The chokecherries along our valley still bear bright fruit. There is good pottery clay north of here. I remember our old places. When I pass the mussel shell, I run my hand along those old grooves in the rock.
Now we come to the really crunchy element of Stafford's work, pacifism. The longer I've looked at his work in this light, the more I am inclined to split a hair between pacifism and war resistance. I believe that Stafford writes more about resisting or critiquing war than about achieving peace. In fact, it was oddly difficult to find a passage to use as words for lighting the peace candle this morning. He was a conscientious objector during World War II, and it was his experience, some would call it internment, in civilian public service camps that got him started writing every morning. He was asked once just when he became a pacifist. He said he didn't become, he always was. His draft board in Hutchinson was headed by a retired military man who asked Stafford how he had come by his objection to war. Stafford said, "You were my Sunday school teacher, sir, when I was a child. You taught me not to kill. I never forgot." And the result was that he was a CO.
At the National Monument along the Canadian border, this is the field where the battle did not happen, where the unknown soldier did not die. This is the field where grass joined hands, where no monument stands, and the only heroic thing is the sky. Birds fly here without any sound, unfolding their wings across the open. No people killed or were killed on this ground, hallowed by neglect and an air so tame that people celebrated by forgetting its name.
At the bomb testing site, at noon in the desert, a panting lizard waited for history, its elbows tense, watching the curve of a particular road as if something might happen. It was looking at something further off than people could see. An important scene acted in stone for little selves at the flute end of consequences. There was just a continent without much on it, under a sky that never cared less. Ready for a change, the elbows waited, the hands gripped hard on the desert.
We'll end with what is probably Stafford's best known poem. It's the most frequently anthologized, although he didn't really enjoy it, think much of it himself. It draws together the ideas of community, the wilderness, and even, though it's not so obvious, his pacifism.
Traveling through the dark. Traveling through the dark, I found a deer dead on the edge of the Wilson River Road. It's usually best to roll them into the canyon. That road is narrow. To swerve might make more dead. By glow of the taillight, I stumbled back to the car and stood by the heap. A doe, a recent killer. She had stiffened already, almost cold. I dragged her off. She was large in the belly. My fingers touching her side brought me the reason. Her side was warm. Her fawn lay there, waiting, alive, still, never to be born. Beside that mountain road, I hesitated. The car aimed ahead, its lowered parking lights. Under the hood, heard the steady engine. I stood in the glare of the warm exhaust turning red. Around our group, I could hear the wilderness listen. I thought hard for us all. It's my only swerve. And then pushed her over the edge into the river. A commentary later on had this quote from Stafford. Let me confess, I didn't really push the deer into the river. I guess it was poetic license, and I hope I didn't induce anyone else to do so reckless in that. Over the years, I have suffered a number of criticisms for my poem, some of them from people who thought it was too sentimental and shouldn't have even thought about doing something for the deer or the fawn. Let's be good citizens. I'll try to do my part.
That piece of commentary attached to Traveling Through the Dark goes on to say, I've had trouble with people in political discussions about pacifism. I remember once taking a stand. Well, I can't stop war. Jesus couldn't stop war. Eisenhower couldn't stop war. Why should I blame myself for not stopping war? What I can do is to do the things that are within my power. I can decide there's one person who won't be in it. That's a possibility, but I can't stop war. Someone who was there kept saying, well, that's just not good enough for me. You know, he had this John Wayne reaction, I'm going to stop it. But that leads you to terrorist acts that don't really do any good, but they relieve your conscience. I don't want to relieve my conscience. I want to do good. These poems are challenging, and those challenges in the poems are, for me, the closest Stafford comes to being aggressive. His pacifism was so thorough that he did not want to be aggressive in any way. He disagreed vehemently with many anti-Vietnam protesters whose tactics he thought were almost as terrorist as war itself. His son Kim said, the goal of the COs was not to win, but to include. Or, as Shel Silverstein said, to play hug of war, where everyone wins. I want to thank our readers this morning for making the poems come alive, and I hope that this sampling of William Stafford's poetry will lead you to explore it further on your own. I believe he's one of us.